online at weru.org. You can also mail a check to P.O. Box 170, East Orland, Maine 04431. For all you do to keep WERU going strong, thank you.
Radioactive is made possible in part by Artisan Builders, providing environmental design, construction, and renovation for homeowners and local businesses since 1992. 525-7740.
All right, the time is just before 4 o'clock, and you are tuned to WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill, 102.9 Bangor, and streaming online at weru.org. There we go, and this is Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal with Amy Brown and Meredith DeFrancesco for December 10th, 2009. The 15th United Nations Conference on Climate Change, also known as COP15, got underway in Copenhagen this week with representatives from 192 countries, NGOs, indigenous peoples groups, scientists, activists, and others coming together in hopes that an international agreement can be reached to address the climate change crisis. Smaller countries, poorer countries, and islanders who are already feeling the impacts of climate change more severely are pitted against giant industrialized nations like the U.S. and China, who are the most responsible and the most resistant to change. Earlier today at a press conference in Copenhagen, a spokesperson for the 43-member Alliance of Small Island States told a news conference that 100 nations have signed on to a goal for limiting rises in temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels that would require cuts in greenhouse gas emissions by rich nations of at least 45% from 1990 levels by 2020. In a separate statement issued earlier today, the group of 77, representing the majority of the world's developing countries, urged the United States to join the Kyoto Protocol and to commit to emission reductions comparable to those of other industrialized nations. Lumumba Stanislaus D. Aping, a chair of the G77, stated, quote, "The U.S. is the world's largest emitter historically and per capita. A reduction of 4% compared to 1990 will not help save the world. We ask the U.S. to join the Kyoto Protocol and take on commitments comparable to Annex I countries, the other industrialized countries." He went on to say, "This is a challenge that President Barack Obama needs to rise to as a Nobel Prize winner and as an advocate of a multilateral global society. We know he's proud to be part of that community through his family relations in Africa. The American Congress approves billions of dollars in defense budgets. Can you not approve $200 billion to save the world?" End quote. Today on Radioactive, we talk with two people who will be participating in the COP15 conference. James Hogan is the co-author with Richard Littlemore of Climate Cover-Up, The Crusade to Deny Global Warming, and head of desmogblog.com. And Janet Redman is a former resident of Hancock County who is now the co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. We spoke with James Hogan earlier this afternoon.
We have with us by phone Jim Hogan, the co-author of the recently published book titled Climate Cover-Up, The Crusade to Deny Global Warming, and co-founder of the DSmog blog. Literature on climate cover-up states, propaganda, conflicting news reports, mysterious experts, forged signatures, mocked-up lawsuits, special interest groups, and corporations are all elements of a scheme that has been executed ingeniously over many years to confuse the public and create doubt and doubt about the severity of climate change. Jim Hogan is going to be in Copenhagen tomorrow. He joins us today by phone from Vancouver. Welcome to the program.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So can you really lay out for us just how industry has, since at least the early 90s, waged a massive propaganda assault that has slowed and circumvented the wheels of education and action concerning climate change and its implications? And certainly that would have implications on just where we are internationally on any action on climate change.
You bet. I just wanted to point out that I'm a public relations guy. I've been in the public relations business for 35 years, and I read a lot, about what my industry is doing. And I came across this story that we ended up writing a book about around a little over 4 years ago. And I was kind of stunned by the scope of this misinformation campaign that was basically an attack on climate scientists that was funded by the oil and gas industry, the coal industry, and the utilities industry, and implemented by right-wing think tanks, in particular in North America. In my 35 years, I've never seen anything as comprehensive as this. You know, it doesn't matter whether you look at tobacco or DDT or asbestos. My industry has, a history of mischief when it comes to public relations, protecting industrial interests that are harming the environment, but nothing of this scope.
And can you talk then about some of these specifics of some of these very points that we just listed in the introduction of the propaganda, of the mysterious experts, forged signatures, these sorts of details as you've lined them up in your studying?
Well, probably the most significant feature of these campaigns is this attempt by industry to overcome the credibility problem that it has with the public when it speaks about the environment. And industry, decades ago, realized that it was losing that battle. And I think instead of actually trying to deal with the environmental issues on an operational level, has employed public relations techniques and compliant scientists to send a message to the public that creates doubt around the science of climate change. And they do that through industry front groups or kind of fake grassroots organizations. We call them AstroTurf groups. There's a famous one called the Advancement of Sound Science Coalition that was put together by Philip Morris that invited Exxon and other fossil fuel companies to join it. And basically it was an attack on science, an attempt to undermine the public's confidence in science on everything from secondhand smoke to greenhouse gas emissions. And that model that was developed in the early 90s has evolved into and morphed into different organizations, dozens of them, that are put together by the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the American Petroleum Institute, and various other industry associations that are sort of fighting industry interests. There's a group recently called the Americans for Clean Coal Electricity that launched a $40 million campaign trying to convince Americans in swing states in the last presidential election that there was such a thing as clean coal. They hired an AstroTurf group or a grassroots specialist, a PR firm, on K Street in Washington called Bonner and Associates that was recently caught forging letters stealing letterhead, basically, from legitimate seniors groups and community groups, and then using that letterhead and forging and forged signatures of the executive directors of these groups to pressure elected officials to oppose the Waxman-Markey bill. So that's an example.
I want to read a quote from The Guardian, the UK, George Monbiot, who wrote earlier this week, quote, "The fascinating, funny, and beautifully written new book by James Hogan and Richard Littlemore, if every allegation it contained could not be traced back to leaked documents, and I have checked all the sources, their findings would be unbelievable. Nothing exposed by the hacking of the Climate Research Unit's server is one-tenth as bad as the least of these revelations." So a two-part question. First, how did you come by? What can you say about how you came by this information, the leaked documents? And also, do you want to comment on the leaking of these emails that have happened, just right before the climate talks in Copenhagen?
Well, I mean, I think the short answer to your first question about how we came across these leaked documents is that there are some people out there who are just as horrified by this behavior as we are. And so we get documents leaked to us. We I guess fundamentally the answer, though, is that we have some very good journalists working for DSmog Blog, our blog, and we have done research over 4 years. And also we bring an interesting perspective to it, and that is that, you know, I've been in the public relations business for 35 years, and a number of the other people on my team are also experienced public relations people. So we know what to look for in a plan, and we know what this, you know, the code words a lot of the time in these PR plans actually mean. So I think we had an advantage there. I think that these hacked emails are just another example of this PR campaign. We've read them. There really isn't anything in there that says that climate change isn't still a very serious problem. These emails are not going to stop glaciers from melting. These emails are not going to stop ocean acidification. This is still a very serious problem. But these emails do give these front groups that we write about in the book an opportunity to confuse the public and create this impression that there's something scandalous in these emails. But if you look into it, it's fabrication. And these people are unbelievably talented at fabricating information and creating the impression, creating storms in teapots. That's the business they're in, and they're very, very good at it. It has had an impact on American public opinion and the number of Americans who believe that there's solid science behind this climate change problem. The numbers in a Pew study recently, the numbers of Americans who think the science is solid has dropped from 71% to 57%. So this is serious, and I think that reporters have to start asking these so-called experts that represent these industry front groups the basic questions around their qualifications and their funding. What we found out over the past 4 years is that it's very difficult to find a legitimate climate scientist who says that climate change isn't happening. There are very few real skeptics who are actually doing research on climate science. We have arguments about whether or not there are two or four or six of them. That's how few there are.
You've said that this campaign, as it were, has been going on since the early 1990s. Can you talk about how that dissemination happened through the media, how this information was disseminated, and how damaging you think this has been on where we are today as far as climate change action and education?
Well, one of the things that happens, and it was a good example of this, and a few days ago on the BBC, where there's a fellow named Mark Morano who was at one time a public affairs guy for Senator Inhofe, who's a big climate change skeptic. And Morano was basically a political bully. So they put him on CNN with this climate scientist who basically is just a scientist. And he's very knowledgeable, unlike Morano, but not so knowledgeable about what it takes to get, you know, to do well on television. So you have Morano, who's like the mafia, up against this poor climate scientist who's like a Boy Scout. And he kind of beats this guy up to the point where the climate scientist, I won't use the word that he used to describe Morano, but it that type of thing where you create this kind of fake debate where you treat science as if it's just another point of view has reoccurred. That model of covering climate change has reoccurred over the past couple of decades, and given the public the impression that there's some kind of debate going on, when you look at the scientific literature as opposed to mainstream media, that debate is actually not happening in scientific literature. The debate is actually between PR people like Morano, or some of them who have PhDs, but essentially are performing a public relations function because they don't have science on their side. They're not actually doing science. And legitimate climate scientists who aren't used to this kind of battling over facts. they discuss whether or not what their theory is as substance in scientific literature, not in the Wall Street Journal.
And how damaging do you think that this has been on the public's perception, particularly in the United States and Canada?
Well, I think most people in Canada and the United States have no idea what climate change is. They don't know what causes it. Lots of them are concerned about it, but they don't know what causes it, they don't know how it works, and they don't know what to do about it. They don't know what the solutions are. So I think that it's basically caused an enormous amount of confusion. There are huge percentages of the population of North Americans who believe that there's a huge debate about whether or not it's even happening. And I think the main damage that they have done is they have essentially derailed a conversation about how do we fix climate change, and instead misdirected everyone into a false discussion about whether or not it's actually happening. I think that's the same thing is going on with these hacked emails. It really is a red herring, but the world is actually looking at the red herring rather than looking at the solution to climate change.
Well, the red herring on the surface is a lot easier to understand for most people. It doesn't take the time and the effort that it takes to actually read the science.
Yeah, this is a file that people have to pick up. For me, if you have the Competitive Enterprise Institute saying it's not happening, and then on the other side you have NASA, the National Academy of Sciences, the Royal Society, and virtually every scientific academy in the world saying the climate is changing, humans have something to do with it, and it's serious. And on the other side you have the Competitive Enterprise Institute, you know, excuse me for believing NASA.
So you're getting ready, you're packing. As soon as you're done talking with us, you're going to go finish packing to go to Copenhagen. What do you hope and what do you expect will come out of this COP15?
I hope that there is going to be a political commitment, an agreement, that will evolve into a treaty later on in 2010 when Waxman-Markey makes its way through the or whatever the bill ends up being called, makes its way through the Senate.
Thanks for joining us here today. We wish you luck in Copenhagen. Jim Hogan, who is the author of the new book, Climate Cover-Up, The Crusade to Deny Global Warming, and also the co-founder of, where is it?
DeSmogBlog.com, and it's DeSmogBlog.com.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Joining us live by phone now from the Copenhagen Climate Talks is Janet Redman, the co-director of the Institute for Policy Studies, Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. You may recognize Janet Redman's name and voice as she used to do a weekly segment on WERU for the Union River Watershed Coalition. Thanks for joining us today, Janet.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yay,
and we have been having some phone difficulties, so we hope we'll be able to keep you on.
Yep.
There are numerous angles we know you could talk about from your vantage point, but let's start with the tug of war over targets. A number of countries have said that a 45% reduction from 1990 levels by 2020 of CO2 emissions would be appropriate, while the U.S. has been talking about 20% reductions from 2005 levels by the same time, which would actually only equal 4% reduction. Can you talk about targets and the recent Danish-U.S. agreement and the idea that more developed nations who have created the majority of climate change should be responsible for giving funding for poorer nations to make a transition to a lower carbon economy and for adaptation measures in countries where they're already experiencing drastic climate change effects like the Maldives and Bangladesh? Talk about those issues if you can.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Thanks. Thanks for having me on the program. It's great to be able to talk to listeners here from Copenhagen inside the Bella Center where negotiations are taking place. On the targets, I think it's actually really important to think about our role as U.S. citizens in this. When we look at the target that, of course, is on the table, which is 20% by 2005 levels, and dig deeper into that number, as you mentioned, that's really 4%. By 1990 levels, which is what everyone else uses as a baseline and what's the baseline in the Kyoto Protocol. But when you dig even deeper into the U.S. legislation that's on the table in the Senate and the amount of offsets that are presumably going to be a part of that, and offsets mean where we basically outsource our responsibility to make emissions cuts, we're actually looking at, in the U.S., not having to reduce our emissions until the year 2030. So we're talking about really, really bad targets, basically inaction and going in the wrong direction. But yeah, so some of the most highly impacted developing countries have put the number of 45% on the table. Actually, Bolivia has put a proposal on the table calling for at least 49% emissions reductions. What the Danish text did was lower those emission standards significantly, lower our expectations for what kind of reductions we need to make in the rich world. What it also has done is called for one unified text, and that does a couple things that are really important. One is it sidelines or makes obsolete the Kyoto Protocol, which is the only legally binding text that exists right now to hold developed countries accountable for the greenhouse gas emissions. What the Danish text and other proposals that are saying we need one Copenhagen Treaty are doing is changing the legal framework and the legal focus from the Kyoto Protocol to a new negotiating track that's happening in another place within here in the Bella Center. It's the track where developing countries are treated. It's the track where the U.S. has been put because they refused to sign the Kyoto Protocol. And they're calling for a system of pledge and review. Basically, that's the idea where you can just kind of say what you want to do around climate, write down a number, and there's no way to hold you accountable. So it gets away from the legally binding piece. It gets away from an aggregate target that the entire planet has to agree to in order to keep emissions levels under dangerous levels, and it gets rid of any compliance mechanism. What it also does is blur the line between rich and impoverished countries and blurs the line of historical responsibility and climate debt. So in fact, by erasing the historical responsibility of rich countries, you blur the line again of what kind of finance is needed. Right now, what we're looking at is a huge need for a north-to-south transfer. The World Bank, which is probably underestimating, is calling for at least $500 to $600 billion a year in developing country needs for adaptation and mitigation. Mitigation means basically that rich developing countries need to develop. Everyone deserves the right to things like access to energy, being able to read at night, but that it's going to have to happen in a way very different than rich countries developed. It's going to have to be low carbon based or zero carbon based if possible. And that's going to mean a whole lot of support because those technologies are expensive at this point. So this new proposal that blurs those lines about whose responsibility is it to reduce emissions and whose responsibility is it to pay is really dangerous, both because it bucks the science of what's necessary, and it creates a politically untenable situation. It's going to be really hard for a country like India to tell people in their own country who still have a per capita emissions level less than one-fifth the level of folks in the U.S., that, hey, we're going to be treated just like the folks in the U.S., even though the vast majority of people living in this country are poor.
Do you have a sense of what the political will might be there to push the United States and other more developed countries to aim for a 45% reduction from 1990 levels?
Yeah, I mean, the political will really at this point feels like it's coming from leadership in the progressive countries, in the ALBA countries, for example, the countries like Bolivia and Ecuador, in countries who are going to feel the worst impact. So the developing island states like Tuvalu and Maldives that are going to cease to exist as nations, and countries in the Africa group, particularly those in sub-Saharan Africa, who are looking at temperature rises that are probably going to be 1.5 times the global average temperature rise and are going to see massive drought, crop failures. It's going to be really devastating for populations. So these folks have not only the moral authority, but also the reality that climate change is going to hit them first and worst. You're also seeing, I think, a lot of push and political will being built by the NGO community, by civil society, both inside the Bella Center, which are mostly, you know, large nonprofit groups, but also some smaller grassroots movements, but then outside of the official talks in a place called the Klima Forum, which is a civil society space, and I think we'll see on Saturday during the large flood, it's a large demonstration or march called the Flood, where they're expecting tens of thousands of people to come to Copenhagen to express their outrage at the fact that developed countries are not putting binding legal targets on the table and basically are expecting the developing world to roll over and die because of it.
Now, Janet, that's where the pressure is coming from. What about the optimism
optimism level among those folks that anything will come out of this that will be, that they'll be able to affect, in particular, Obama, the optimism around Obama? Is there a level that optimism around that he actually might sign on to something, or are people feeling fairly discouraged about that?
I think Obama presents an interesting problem, actually. Obama has still has a lot of good kind of PR capital, so there's a lot of goodwill in Europe and lots of other parts of the world who see Obama as a progressive force and a force of multilateralism. You know, he's getting the Nobel Peace Prize for what he represents, not necessarily what he's done, but what people hope he will do in the name of multilateralism. And respect and leadership in the world. I think, unfortunately, the U.S., although the tone has changed, they're a lot more approachable, the negotiators are much more reasonable, the actual politics hasn't changed much from the Bush era. You know, we're no longer climate deniers, thank goodness, but it's kind of like you don't get a prize for just showing up at the table, you get a prize for actually completing your own responsibilities. We're legally bound through the Convention on Climate, UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which we signed in 1992 as the U.S., to lower our emissions and to provide financial and technical support to developing countries to take actions. While some of us, I think, in the community are hopeful that Obama was going to be a new era, we have yet to see the evidence of that in the policies that he and U.S. negotiators are pushing here in Copenhagen.
And talking again from the U.S. perspective and the cap and trade that's currently being debated by the U.S. as an action to take, can you talk about this idea of carbon markets and carbon offsets and whether that is actually any kind of solution?
Sure. In fact, I'd be happy to tell your listeners about a new viral video we've just released with Annie Leonard from The Story of Stuff. It's called The Story of Cap and Trade, and you can find it on the web at www.storyofcapandtrade.com. And that gives a 9-minute overview of what cap and trade is and what the problems have been so far and why we think it's a false solution to the climate crisis. Basically, cap and trade is two things. One, it puts a cap on carbon, which of course is wonderful. We think there should be a limit on the carbon emissions that are being released into the atmosphere. But the second part, which is trading of carbon, is really problematic. Carbon trading has nothing to do with reductions. This is just the second part has absolutely nothing to do with lowering reductions. It means you can move carbon reductions around the planet by trading permits. So each permit represents the right to pollute 1 ton of carbon dioxide. Of course, as the cap is lowered, these permits become worth actual money because it costs money to reduce emissions. So companies that find it really hard to reduce their emissions will continue to pollute, but will use a lower cost option to buy permits from other companies who are able to reduce their emissions. So it's basically a way for companies to say, hey, it's too expensive for me to reduce my emissions. I'm going to pay someone else to do it for me. That's problematic, particularly when it happens in one country. But the really scary piece is carbon offsetting, which means that companies who are operating within a capped area basically pay companies in an uncapped area to reduce emissions for them. So all of a sudden, you've punched a hole in the cap. You're saying that there's an equivalency between these carbon dioxide emissions when really they're in two different systems. One is regulated. The other is not part of the carbon cap at all whatsoever. So you're actually, in many cases, creating perverse incentives for emissions to go up and rewarding those most polluting industries, particularly in the global south.
And any last words? I'm sorry, we have to wrap it up right now, Janet.
Sure.
Redman. Go ahead. Yeah, do you have any last
thoughts? I just want to encourage folks to really take a broad perspective when they look at climate change and climate solutions and to think about the climate justice implications, which are both ecological but also environmental and social.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us today, Janet Redman with the Institute for Policy Change's Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. She joins us today from the Copenhagen Climate Talks. Thanks for joining us, Janet.
Thanks, Janet.
Thanks very much.
And we'll be covering the talks on next week's Radioactive as well.
Right.
Thanks for joining us. This has been Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal. I'm Meredith DeFrancesco.
And I'm Amy Brown. You can listen to our archived programs along with most of WERU's locally produced news and public affairs programs on WERU's website. Go to the archives at weru.org.
Thanks for listening and acting.
Support for WERU comes from Duffy's Restaurant, located right next to the WERU station on Route 1 in East Orleans, serving home-style cooking for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, featuring fresh haddock, fried, or broiled every Friday and Saturday night. More information at 469-3030.